Years after he came back to the Christian faith, Lewis said that his monstrous individualism was at the core of his rejection of God. And I think that's something that pretty much everybody can identify with.
Welcome to another edition of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. How familiar are you with the long journey C.S. Lewis took to becoming an ex-atheist? Well, with me on the show today to help with that is Dr. Joel D. Heck, author of From Atheism to Christianity, The Story of C.S. Lewis, and it just came out here in 2017, which is the year we are recording. It brings together greater clarity to the time period when Lewis didn't embrace the Christian faith. Welcome back to All About Jack, Joel.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you once again.
Now, regular listeners to the show are aware of the fact that C.S. Lewis resisted Christianity for many years, I'm sure, but the general public or the more casual listener usually know him most as the author of just the Narnia stories or the classic Mere Christianity. So, for a minute here, just thinking of the latter audience less familiar with Lewis, tell us briefly why this period is so important, along with why you wrote about it, given that there are some other books that focus on it.
Well, a few years ago, I got this idea that Lewis was an atheist, maybe the most famous atheist of the 20th century, and nobody has really studied his atheism. And add to that the fact that the period of the 1920s is relatively little known in the life of Lewis. We know a little bit about it. He even talks about it in his autobiography. But bringing those two together in a study that is really fundamentally about Lewis's adoption of atheism and the reasons why he decided to set atheism aside, but after a 15-year journey.
Well, now, even though you've been on the show twice before, and the last, though, was over 4 years ago before I moved my audio files to the current hosting location, which I did in late 2014, I mention this because at the time that I'm recording this, I haven't yet reposted all my earlier shows, and sadly, those two are among those that haven't been reposted. Hopefully, by the time people listen to this later on from 2017 or even a few months after it's released, I'll have that corrected and have at least one of your shows on and eventually get to the other. But anyway, so some listeners may not know who you are is the reason why I say all that. So what and where do you teach and how long have you been reading Lewis?
Well, currently I'm a visiting professor at Concordia Lutheran Seminary in Edmonton, Alberta. But normally I'm at Austin, Texas, at Concordia University, Texas, one of the 10 Concordias in a system of universities, liberal arts universities with a strong Christian foundation. So that's where I'm at. I'm primarily an Old Testament professor, but I also teach a good bit of C.S. Lewis and a little bit of Reformation history. And I've been working with Lewis since about 1995 when I studied Lewis in order to teach a class in London, England, back when we had the opportunity to participate in a study abroad program.
Diving into your book now, which is again called From Atheism to Christianity, in your preface you state that the first two of your 9 chapters focus on how Lewis initially embraced atheism, along with the key factors in him moving towards it and away from not believing in God. Tell us some of the highlights that is in store for the reader.
Well, years after he came back to the Christian faith, Lewis said that his monstrous individualism was at the core of his rejection of God. And I think that's something that pretty much everybody can identify with. We kind of like to be our own person. And this came to a head for Lewis in his early teen years. But he also talks about some of the surface reasons, at least, for becoming an atheist. And he writes in a letter to a friend in 1946, "The early loss of my mother," his mother died when he was 9, "great unhappiness at school." He chronicles his agonizing experiences in public schools in the UK at great length in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. Then he says, "and the shadow of the last war and presently the experience of it," so he's talking about World War I that kind of cemented him in his atheism, "had given me a very pessimistic view of existence. My atheism was based on it." In addition to that, his father was in part to blame or maybe responsible for his negative experiences at school, because it was about a month after the death of Lewis's mother that the father sent him across the Irish Sea to go to a school in Watford, England. And so he probably blamed his father significantly for that, at least the correspondence between the two brothers, Warren and Jack Lewis, indicates as such. They drew closer to one another as they drew further away from their father. So the alienation of the brothers to their father led them both away from their Christian faith.
Next, then, in your book, you recount the changes in Lewis's life in terms of his beliefs from the years 1916 to 1931 over the next five chapters. Now, why did you break the material into that division and cover those years within those five chapters? And can you provide some of the most significant ground you cover in those chapters?
Certainly, I was looking for natural divisions in the material, and since Lewis talks about his spiritual journey in terms of four major chess moves, it would have been nice to have one chapter on each of the four chess moves. But that didn't really work out because, as I look at the history of that decade, two of them happened very close to one another in 1924, and the other two happened within a few months of one another in 1930. So there were some natural breaks in the material. So I tried to keep a similar chapter length from one chapter to the next, but also break it at different significant points in Lewis's life. In addition, during that time, I was taking a look at the date of Lewis's conversion, and you know all about the redating of Lewis's conversion to theism that Alistair McGrath and Andrew Lazo have both documented, McGrath in his biography and Lazo in a letter. Lewis famously says that it was in Trinity Term of 1929 that he admitted that God was God and became a theist at that point. Truth of the matter is that it was 1930, and one can understand Lewis writing about his conversion to theism 2.5 decades after the fact and getting it wrong by 1 year. He could picture in his mind the time of year that it happened, the weather that was outside, those sorts of things, but he got it off by 1 year precisely. I mean, sometimes I have trouble remembering which day last week I did this, that, or the other thing. So 25 years later, we can understand that. But there's a place where he talks about, in a letter to Arthur Greaves, his lifelong and childhood friend, that something had been holding him back for about the last year. And he says that in October of 1931. So about a year takes us back to June of 1930, not to June of 1929, which would be 2 years instead of 1 year. So there are a number of things, that piece of information, the chapel attendance that Lewis starts up at his college, Magdalen College, in the fall of 1930. He and Warren deciding to make Holy Trinity in Headington Quarry, their parish church. That happens in 1930. And all of this, I think, significantly precipitated by the death of Albert Lewis, their father, in September of 1929. I really think the death of Albert and a realization of how poorly the two brothers had treated their father over the years were significant reasons for Lewis taking a look at himself in a new way and understanding the guilt of his past behavior towards his father. Whether it was deserved or not, it was still wrong on his part. And so those are some of the significant reasons for dating Lewis's conversion to theism in the summer of 1930 rather than 1929. Lewis just made a mistake, and in a couple places he admits that he's not real good with dates.
Right, which is surprising to some who, hear about Lewis having such a great memory. Of course, that's about what he read. But as you're noting, within our own personal life, sometimes it's difficult, or it's definitely difficult to remember certain things. And in my own life, like things that weren't so great that happened, like say 10 years ago, give or take what year they happen, I not exactly sure. But now you mentioned also, in addition to Alistair McGrath's book, material that Andrew Lazo is covered. I believe that's in the Journal 7, which the Waite Center publishes, that you're referring to what he's done, correct?
Yes, it is volume 30. The year is 2012, and he wrote an article entitled Correcting the Chronology, Some Implications of Early Prose Joy. And that's about a year before McGrath's book came out. So I suspect Andrew came to that realization earlier than McGrath did.
Yeah, I'm not sure now with the lead time for publishing. And I think sometimes the seven was published later than the year came out. So I could be wrong on that, but
That's true.
either way, the material is out there. I wanted to just clarify where Andrew Lazo's material was. Well, now additional follow-up question to what we're covering here, and that is, I was noticing that two individuals endorse your book that actually have covered similar ground to what you cover. And you were mentioning the chess moves. I didn't know in terms of how you approach the material either differently or the same, as in addition to any comments about them endorsing your book.
Well, both David Downing and Devin Brown, and in addition to being wonderful Lewis scholars, are also English professors. So they approach the story of Lewis's conversion very much from a literary perspective. I'm more of a theologian and historian. I teach a lot of biblical history, and I was fascinated by the history of Lewis's 15-year journey. We now know a great deal more about those 15 years than we ever did, because of something I'll tell you about a little bit later, that the chronology of Lewis's life during the 1920s especially. And so to read about the things that he says in his letters, indications of movement in his spiritual journey, books that he's reading, people he's becoming friends with, a lot of whom are Christians, as well as the approach to philosophy in Oxford at the time, where realism, which is a very materialistic philosophy in the early 1920s, was dominant until mid to late 1920s, when idealism took over. And Lewis himself had identified with idealism as an atheist and as a materialist who didn't believe that there was anything other than the five senses could experience. He shifted to idealism because he was asked to teach philosophy as well as English literature when he became a professor at Oxford University in 1925. But he also filled in for a realist philosopher who took a leave of absence for a year to teach at the University of Michigan, and in his place he had to teach philosophy. So in the 1924-1925 school year, as well as the months leading up to that, he's reading a lot of realist philosophy and idealist philosophy, and it's during that prep time that the first two chess moves occur, one while he's reading Euripides, believe it or not, a Greek playwright from the 5th century BC, and the other while he's reading Samuel Alexander, a philosopher. So those two come together. That's some of the information that's spelled out, as well as a lot of the other experiences he has, some as a young professor where he finds himself overcommitted and almost without time to think, his conversations with Owen Barfield, his continued letter writing to Arthur Greaves and others. And I operate under the assumption that if there was a major change in thought that took place in Lewis's life, he wrote about it somewhere. If not in a diary, which he kept off and on for about 6 years in the middle of the 20s, then in a book, a poem, or especially in his letters. So there's a lot of additional information available about the years 1916 to 1931 that wasn't even available to Devin Brown or David Downing when they wrote their books.
Well, now taking a break from this book that we're talking about, let's briefly consider some of the other Lewis-related materials you've published or been involved in. I'm thinking mostly about the two other interviews we did about your book Examining Lewis and Education, if you can give us the name of that. And then we covered actually two things in the other conversation about your Lewis calendar and then the Socratic Digest, which you didn't really edit per se. I guess maybe you did some editing, but you were a major force in getting it republished. So what can you tell the listener about these things?
Well, my first book that I wrote for my own research was Irrigating Deserts, subtitled C.S. Lewis on Education. That came out in 2005. And was a study of Lewis as an educator, not only how he went about lecturing and teaching, but what he taught and how he himself was taught, very much steeped in the liberal arts as an undergraduate at Oxford University. Then I edited a book that had gone out of print called The Personal Heresy, which is Lewis debating back and forth with a Cambridge English professor by the name of E.M.W. Tilliard. And that came out, I think, in 2008. And it's being republished now, I believe, by HarperCollins and a series of other books. Then I did The Socratic Digest, which was a listing of program notes and lectures that were given at the Socratic Club in Oxford, an undergraduate society devoted to debating issues relative to the Christian faith. And that was between about 1942 and 1953. So they kept notes of lectures as well as published the notes and some actual essays that were written out or typed out by the various speakers at the Socratic Club. So that's available on lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. I just pulled it together, typed out all the manuscript, proofread it, and it's a publishing on demand website where anybody that's interested, especially in the philosophical world that Lewis lived within, can get a copy of the Socratic Digest. It was not available anywhere, and it is now. And then this book came around in terms of major publications. The Lewis Calendar came out a couple of years ago, which was a listing of some significant event happening in the life of either Jack Lewis or Warren Lewis for every day of the calendar year. And it's a perpetual calendar so that it's not confined to one particular calendar year. And that's still available. Still have a few copies of that available. And maybe one other thing that's going to come out in the next issue of Seven, the Wade Center's publication. I think I told you about this, but there was an essay previously unpublished in the last few decades, but of course originally published in the 1940s by C.S. Lewis. It was discovered by a New Zealander, an essay called A Christmas Sermon for Pagans. So the next issue of Seven should contain the article co-written by Christopher Marsh, the New Zealander, and I, and the Wade Center is trying to get permission from the Lewis estate to also print the essay or sermon itself along with our article about that essay. So that's most of what I've done apart from several dozen articles on Lewis and different aspects of his life and writings.
Oh, very interesting. I don't think I had heard or I'd forgotten about the essay. I definitely do look forward to that. Well, now, returning to your current book, which is again From Atheism to Christianity, in the final two chapters, you finish by providing a recap of Lewis's return to the faith and then his reflections on atheism. What are some of the highlights?
Well, those chapters go into a lot of detail, and this late chapter, this summary or overview of Lewis's conversion is intended to pull all of that together and be, like you say, highlights of that conversion. So this is the eighth chapter, The Return to Christianity, an overview. So I talk about his reasons for atheism, his monstrous individualism. He talks about his willful blindness. I talk about the ambivalence that he expressed towards his atheism, especially later in his atheistic period, because when he wrote Mere Christianity or did the BBC broadcasts that led to Mere Christianity, he talked about how having defended a Christian doctrine, sometimes it seems least cogent right after he's ended up defending it. But he says there are also times when, as an atheist, Christianity looked terribly probable. So he admits that, and that's an interesting insight into Lewis's openness to considering other points of view. He talks a lot about the books that he read and the friends he made, and I mentioned that a little bit earlier. He also realized that he was actually working hard at keeping God out. And then his father's death, which I mentioned earlier, I think ended up being the precipitating event that helped him to realize that evil is not just out there in society and other people, but it was also resident in his own self, his own ego. In fact, in Surprised by Joy, he talks about at a certain point in time, he looked inside himself. And in Surprised by Joy, he's not clear exactly when that happened because these events are kind of jumbled together in his mind. But he says when he looked inside himself, he saw a zoo of lusts. So he saw all kinds of personal problems inside himself. And I think that that was a major turning point for him to realize the problem of his sin and his need for some help from the outside. Then there's that somewhat well-known story of the unbuckling or the melting that happened when he was riding a double-decker bus and realized that he was trying to keep something at bay, and how he determined that he was going to unbuckle and let these other ideas into his mind. He talks fairly humorously about how he used idealism, which he probably adopted in 1924, 6 years before his conversion to theism. He adopted it as a way of avoiding a personal God. And I think we sometimes do that too, or at least some people, in fact, many people around the world with a vague sort of religiosity think that they are giving enough lip service to God to please him. And they're really avoiding a personal God that might actually hold them accountable. And then we see at the end how Lewis describes his own conversion in the chapter Checkmate, which is, again, part of Surprised by Joy, way at the end of that book. And I think when he writes the story of his adoption of theism and admitting that God was God, he is trying to speak out against the psychology or psychoanalysis of Sigmund Freud, who thought that people who are religious, people who are Christians, believed in God because they wanted this exalted father figure to replace an imperfect father. Lewis makes it very clear in that quotation that he exactly did the exact opposite. He didn't want to believe in God, and he was dragged into the kingdom, in a sense, kicking and screaming, he says, darting his eyes in every direction, looking for a way of escape. So it wasn't wishful thinking at all, like Freud might suggest. He was actually wishing for the very opposite of that. So those are a few of the highlights.
All right. Well, now, this book obviously took some time to write, and one of the things that helped you gather your information, if I understand correctly, is research you did that's available on your website. So for those not already familiar with what's called Chronologically Lewis, which is online, and tell us about your online presence in general and any other aspect regarding that resource.
Certainly. Yeah, the idea for the book came about 4 years ago, and it came in part because of this resource I've been working with for about the last decade. Believe it or not, I was reading Peter Skockel's book, Imagination and the Arts in C.S. Lewis, while working in the Clyde Kilby Reading Room at the Wade Center. And I just purchased the book, and in walks Peter Skockel. I'd never met him before, and I asked him, I got acquainted, we met one another, and during the conversation, I remember asking him if anybody had ever pulled all of this stuff together from the letters and the diaries and the books that Lewis wrote and others have written, and Tolkien's letters where he mentions Lewis a lot. Is there any central clearinghouse where all of the biographical information of C.S. Lewis has been gathered? And he said he didn't think so. And it wasn't too long after that that I decided, well, it's not been done, so I think I'm going to do it. So I've been in the process for about the last decade and nearing completion, by the way. I hope to be done with about 99.9% of it by the end of summer. I started pulling together day by day, month by month, year by year, everything that we knew about the things that Jack and Warren Lewis were doing as they or others had recorded them. So this database is almost 2/3 of a million words long. It's 1,142 pages. Probably would get a little bit longer than that. And it is available in a PDF file on my website. So there's a link from my homepage at joelheck.com. There's a link to Chronologically Lewis. It's the most well-known part of that website, and it serves as a resource for scholars who want to document something historically in the lives of the two brothers, or for the casual Lewis person who wants to read about what's happening at the time that Lewis reads this George MacDonald book, Fantasties, that pretty much everybody agrees, and Lewis himself states, started him on the road back to the Christian faith. So people that want to take a look at that can download the PDF file and search for a particular word or phrase or name and should be able to find all kinds of historical information about the Lewis brothers. So I've done a few other things online. I mentioned the reprint of the Socratic Digest. My website, I have quite a number of PowerPoints that I've used for teaching purposes. I've recently done a series of lectures on the Chronicles of Narnia, one introductory lecture, and then an hour lecture on each of the seven Chronicles of Narnia, drawing things together from several sources. So they are available, outlines of various books, even a PowerPoint summary of the book we're talking about, From Atheism to Christianity, that I just uploaded. So these things are available, as well as a few other things. People can feel free to browse on that website and write to me about any of them if they wish.
Oh, excellent. Yes, it's a very good website that you have, and that Chronologically Lewis is quite an indispensable resource. If someone wants to know some detail about Lewis, here's a nice, easy way of doing it. Of course, we always encourage people to read Lewis directly, and this type of resource is a great supplement to have available. Well, now, you've shared a lot about your book, which is, again, From Atheism to Christianity, and I hope that what you've said has convinced people to consider getting it. But let's wrap up by having you summarize why you believe someone would want to add your book to their physical or digital library.
Well, first of all, I think we learn a little bit more about Lewis, that he was a genuinely convinced atheist, especially in the early years, but he was also what he later called a good atheist. And so we jump to the wrong conclusion, I think, if we adopt a hard-headed rejection of atheists as though they were all strident, violently anti-Christian atheists. There are a lot of good atheists out there who would be willing to listen to somebody talk intelligently about the Christian faith and why it meets the needs of over a billion people worldwide. We need to learn to love the sinner and hate the sin, and atheists are sinners just like we are. So we can love them, and sometimes we can love them into the kingdom. After all, there are a lot of Christians who are former atheists. Many of us know Christians who are former atheists, and Lewis himself was that. He was also an intellectually honest scholar, willing to consider contrary evidence. He would go wherever the evidence went, and that's why he came back to the Christian faith. We get a closer look at Lewis's spiritual journey, and by studying his spiritual journey, we learn some of the reasons why he came back to the Christian faith. And we can also appreciate the challenges that he had to deal with, the death of a mother, the alienation of a father, the at times testy relationship with his brother, at least in the early 1920s, until they became fast friends for the rest of their lives. And so by reading this book, we'll not only understand Lewis, but we'll also understand atheism, and we'll have a better understanding of where many of them are coming from in order to be able to communicate the Christian faith in a winsome way with people outside the kingdom of God at this point in time. And maybe, just maybe, some of them will come back to the Christian faith.
That is definitely a prayer that many people have. Well, Joel, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about your book, and thanks for being on All About Jack again.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, William.
And thank you, my listener, for your interest in All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, and All About Jack is also part of the Theology Mix podcast network. Be sure to check the show notes for any links mentioned during the program. The show notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found and navigated. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, highlights the most recent show on the main page and also has space dedicated to listing past shows and the notes for them. Additionally, you can find a variety of other material on Lewis at EssentialCSLewis.com, including a popular series that explores quotations attributed to him that may not be from him. When you visit my site, be sure to listen to other interviews and special podcasts on a variety of topics, mostly directly related to Lewis. And in case you didn't know, during the week, I occasionally post previously released podcasts on my iTunes feed that you can also find at the Podbean address. If you don't know how to get to the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link to that. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. If you do visit me on iTunes, please consider rating my podcast, as it can help others find it there. Finally, in case you haven't heard, I have a book called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, A Companion and Study Guide to the Screwtape Letters. It is available online at Amazon. Paperback is $14.99, and at last check, the Kindle edition was just $3.49. Buying the book is a great way to help support my podcast. You can learn more about my book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Thanks again for listening to All About Jack.